You're listening to WSFM LP 103.3 in Asheville, North Carolina. This is The Final Straw, a weekly anarchist radio show airing on Sundays between 2 to 3 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. I'm Bursa Goodness.
And I'm William Goodenough.
The show can also be heard on KXCF in Marshall, California, KWTF in Bodega Bay, California, KOWA LP in Olympia, Washington, WCRS LP in Columbus, Ohio, and the pirate station Berkeley Liberation Radio. This show will later be posted on thefinalstrawradio.noblogs.org, and you can see archives of all of our past shows at that site. You can email us at thefinalstrawradio@riseup.net with questions, comments, and suggestions, and you can send us letters at The Final Straw, care of Asheville FM, 864 Haywood Road, Asheville, North Carolina, 28806. This show is brought to you by Firestorm Books and Coffee. Located at 610 Haywood Road, Firestorm Books and Coffee is a worker-owned cooperative in Asheville specializing in offbeat, underground, and independent literature. Firestorm's full catalog of books and zines can be found online at firestorm.coop.
This week, instead of priorly mentioned interview with organizers of No New Animal Labs and supporters of Jessica Burlow, Burst spoke with Greta. Greta is an anti-border activist who works in the UK and Calais, France, about her recent visit to Calais and what she's learned about the recent influxes of refugees coming from North Africa and West Asia. Greta talks a bit about where and why the immigrants are coming and where they're headed and why, how governments and populations have been dealing with the immigrants and the stability of the European Union as a structure. Hopefully, we'll be hearing from No New Animal Labs folks in the near future. More on that project can be found at nonewanimallab.com. More on the case of Jessica Burlow can be found at freejessieb.org. But first, in some recent news,
here's an update on Sean Swain's situation, pulled right from his support page at seanswain.org. We're not sure what's going on, but Sean Swain has been blocked from receiving and presumably sending JPay emails. He's also has not called his primary supporters or us at The Final Straw for a new segment. We'll probably hear from him via snail mail sooner or later, but until then, we've got to assume he's cut off. When we called the prison, when people from seanswain.org called the prison, they told them that he was not in the hole and did not have any restrictions on his communication. It's suspected that he may have been transferred back up to 3B spot, undoing the success of the recent call-in phone effort. They refuse to tell supporters what security level the block he is being held on is, and they got surly and authoritarian when they were asked. It seems that the officers at Sean's newest prison, Warren CI, need to learn their jobs are a whole lot easier when they don't provoke anarchists from across the country to call and check in on the welfare of our friend who they hold captive. Warren CI's phone number is 513-932-3388. You can call Warren CI and ask the same questions that were asked by supporters. Why does Sean not have access to communication? What security level is he being held in? And does the JPay kiosk in his, or any Warren unit, actually work right now? You can also leave Sean's case manager a voicemail by punching extension 2281. So that's 513-932-3388, extension 2281. Or try to talk to Deputy Warden Robert Welch, who maybe got Sean moved from 3B to 3A a few weeks ago. He can be reached at extension 2005. Whatever lucky anarchist happens to be on the call when one of these officers breaks and spills the beans, please drop a line to anarchistswain@gmail.com. Also, his birthday was September 12th, so if you haven't written for a while or miss sending him birthday wishes, please consider dropping a line and letting him and the mailroom monkeys, who have to read all of his incoming mail, know that he is loved and missed. Please take a moment to drop him a line, and you can write him at Sean Swain, 243-205, Warren, CI, P.O. Box 120, 5787, State Route 63, Lebanon, Ohio, 45036.
This comes to you from Eric King's support website. Quote, on September 16, 2014, Eric G. King was arrested and charged with an attempted firebombing of a government official's office in Kansas City, Missouri. Eric allegedly threw a hammer through a window of the building and then two lit bottles, though both failed to ignite. Eric faces a federal life sentence if found guilty at his trial on October 28th of this year. On the eve of Eric's first year in pretrial state captivity, his support group got word about the prison censoring and rejecting his mail. To mark the year since Eric was stolen by the state, the Kansas City, Missouri Anarchist Black Cross and the Omaha, Nebraska Anarchist Black Cross dropped banners in solidarity. The Eric King Defense Committee writes, quote, "Recently a book about the Black Panthers was rejected because the prison evidently considers them a hate group. Around the same time, right-wing Christian literature with homophobic rhetoric made it through to another prisoner. Eric is clearly being targeted for his political beliefs and interests." If you have been writing to Eric and have not heard back from him, it is very possible that he has not received your letters or you have not received his. The prison and the state apparatus of which it is a part is trying to isolate Eric from his supporters. We can't let them do this. Please help by, firstly, writing Eric letters. Please flood the prison with as much mail as you can. This can serve the dual purpose of overwhelming the prison mailroom and helping Eric remember that he has solidarity. Keep track of what you sent to Eric and when you sent it so you can check with him later or call the prison to inquire about why your mail was blocked. You can write him at Eric King, 270-90045, CCA Leavenworth, 100 Highway Terrace, Leavenworth, Kansas, 66048. Send Eric a letter or card today.
In more prisoner news, Mumia Abu-Jamal is continuing to be denied the medical care that he needs to survive his stay in prison at SCI Mahone in Frackville, PA. Hepatitis C is a dangerous liver disease which is growing among poor people and is especially rampant in prisons. Mumia found himself diagnosed with Hep C as well as type 2 diabetes and other medical circumstances in August of this year. Drugs released within the last 18 months show remarkable cure rates of 90-95%. But based on the costs of $60,000 to $85,000 for a 12-week course that pharmaceutical companies are charging, jail and prison authorities here and in jails and prisons across the U.S. are denying the incarcerated access to them. The following is paraphrased from freemumia.com. Quote, "Late in the day on Friday, September 18th, United States Magistrate Judge for the Middle District of Pennsylvania, Caroline Mihalchik, issued a proposed order denying Mumia Abu-Jamal's motion for preliminary injunction and his first amended complaint, seeking immediate treatment for active hepatitis C." Unquote. There's a fundraising campaign to get crowdsourced treatment for Mumia Abu-Jamal, as well as information and a petition on his behalf, available at bit.ly/fightformumia. That's the number 4. And updates on his case can be found at freemumia.com.
In a hopeful note, Eddie Africa of the Move 9 will be up for parole in October of 2015 and is looking for support to hopefully get him out of this ridiculous and horrible stint of incarceration on a bogus charge that have had him inside for 37 years of a 30 to 100 year sentence. From onamove.com, quote, "In October 2015, our brother Eddie Africa is set to make another appearance before the Pennsylvania State Parole Board. Your letters of support are urgently needed. All of the information is below as follows. We are asking for your support at this critical stage to secure the freedom Eddie deserves. Feel free to use parts of this sample letter at onamove.com. You can write it in your own words and with your own experiences of or with Eddie. Note, please send all letters of support to Ori Ross, P.O. Box 575, Times Square Station, New York, New York, 10108-0575, so that they can be reviewed and sent to the parole board. The deadline for letters will be Wednesday, September 30th, 2015. To learn more about the case of the Move 9, you can check out our blog at thefinalstrawradio.noblogs.org and search Move. This next update is from warriorpublications.wordpress.com, which is an excellent news source for indigenous anti-colonial struggles and resistance. It is published in Occupied Coast Salish Territory, or so-called Vancouver, Canada. Some background on this update. The Pacific Northwest LNG, or liquid natural gas, is a proposed natural gas liquefaction and export facility on Leelu Island in northeast British Columbia. The facility would liquefy and export natural gas produced by the company Progress Energy. Leelu Island and Flora Banks have historically been home to the Lac Halam First Nation for over 10,000 years, and this group holds the title to the land. Leelu Island is also an essential habitat for migrating juvenile fish and other shellfish. Earlier this spring, members of the Lac Halam First Nation rejected a $1.15 billion package from the company for the rights to build on Leelu Island. However, corporations are not to be trusted, and since August 15th of this year, Lac Halam members and accomplices have had an encampment on Leelu Island to make sure that no drilling or building has been taking place. Here's an update from the camp. Quote, on September 12th at approximately 7 a.m., the drilling vessel Quinn Delta attempted to drill on the northwest edge of Flora Banks. Members of the Lac Suela, or Leelu Island, occupation camp approached the workers on the vessel to explain that no drilling has been permitted and that all drilling activities must cease. The workers on the vessel then desisted from drilling. However, a barge pulled by the tugboat Kadal from Wainwright Marine Services dropped markers on the water to prepare for further unauthorized work. As of 9 p.m., the vessel and equipment still appear to be immobilized on the bank due to mechanical failure. While this was happening on the water, over 30 people came out from many different nations to show their support. We expect the drilling boat to attempt work on the bank again tomorrow. We continue to need additional boats on the water and people on the island, as we have been told that helicopters may attempt to land for on-island drilling. End quote. To learn more about this situation and to keep updated, you can visit Warrior Publications at warriorpublications.wordpress.com. And people who are involved in this struggle have called for physical and financial support to keep Petronas off of their territories, which is the company doing the drilling. To help them out, you can visit bit.ly/Leelu Island. That's LEELUISLAND.
We're speaking with Greta, a pro-immigrant activist based out of the UK, about the ongoing refugee crises in Europe. Thanks for chatting, Greta.
Hi, everyone.
The last time we spoke, you were at the immigration choke point between the UK and France, and thus the rest of Europe, in Calais. Well, you just got back from Calais. What did you experience there, and who did you meet?
So I came back a couple of days ago, and I just stayed for a few days, very brief visit. But the situation is out of control, I would say. So when we spoke last year, I think there were around 600, 700 migrants in Calais. There is now between 3,500 and 4,000 migrants. So yeah, way more than doubled. And that's because it's harder to cross, so more people get stuck for longer periods. And they now live in what is called and really well known as the jungle, which is not really a refugee camp. It's more like tents in, 7 kilometers from the town. So the police managed to evict them and then push them farther and farther. And they're now living in this huge slum. And there's people from different countries. There's many more Syrians than there were when I was there last year. There's around 300 Syrians in Calais at the moment. And then there is the usual nationalities, so Afghans, Eritreans, Sudanese mainly, but also some Egyptian and some Iranian, for example. And I would also say that the population is more diverse. So there are more women and definitely more children and a huge number of unaccompanied minors. The youngest one was 8 years old.
So with the unaccompanied minors, how are they making their way? Are they just like latching on to a friendly adult or a friendly family and traveling with them, or just seem to be doing it on their own?
I think most of them are kind of guided through the countries with the help of traffickers or smugglers that probably their parents paid for in the country of origin. But once they get to Calais, it's a bit wild. You go and you're on your own. But they're really vulnerable because the government has put in place some space for women and children, but not for unaccompanied minors, which is a big problem because they are very young and very vulnerable. And then, yeah, they just get into the lorries or in the trains. But at the moment, like, almost no one is crossing because there is huge fences now in Calais. So it looks more similar to Ceuta and Melilla in Morocco, the Spanish enclave in Morocco, where there are these very, very high fences with like wire on top of it. And it's almost impossible to cross, and people try to cross on the trains, so on the Eurotunnel, but it's extremely dangerous. And between June and now, I think around 10 people died. Not sure of the number. I don't remember exactly the number, but yeah, there's been an increase in people dying trying to cross. And that's due to the higher security. So they need to take greater risk to cross.
For folks outside of Europe, can you quickly break down how immigration and deportation has worked throughout Europe until recently?
Yeah, so the asylum system is supposed to be coordinated in Europe, and there is a convention called the Dublin Convention. So an asylum seeker should claim asylum in the first country that he get across in Europe. And this is meant to be because you're not meant to be picky. So you need a safe space, a safe place. You get to any of this country and you should claim asylum there. If you get fingerprinted in one country, that could be, for example, Italy, and then you decide to go further, to go to France or England, you could be deported back to the first country that you crossed. So in that case, you would be deported back to Italy. Obviously, with this really, high number of refugees coming through, countries like Greece and Italy have tried to put more pressure on Europe to have to try and build a fair system, because of course the Dublin Convention is not fair, because it's obvious that everyone will never get as a first country to the UK, and they will all cross through the Mediterranean countries. So countries have been trying to advocate for the Dublin Convention to be revisited, or at least for a quota system, which means every European country, based on the population and the possibility of employment, should be taking a quota of refugees. And the idea is to take them directly without the need for the migrants to cross the sea, for example, or cross the borders, but to take them directly from refugee camps, for example, around Lebanon or Turkey. And Europe have shown the real face of the European Union. So the countries such as the UK, which has a great potentiality to support people, have just said, well, not really, thank you. So only very recently, the UK, just after the picture of that young baby from Syria came out and there was a lot of pressure, then they say, well, we will take some more Syrian refugees. But so far, they have taken like 250. So nothing, like, yeah.
From what I recall hearing a debate on the BBC a few nights ago, there was a discussion of that policy statement by Cameron in the UK, the Prime Minister, stating that they would take a certain number of asylum seekers and refugees who had been processed by the UN as refugees, which seems like it's even a sneaky way of saying, well, if they come to the borders here and they haven't gone through the process, then they're going to be deported back to the first nation of contact and then deported back to their home country and then attempt to file for asylum refugee status from their home country. Does that sound right? Is that what that seems to be doing? Or
what they're trying to say is, we don't take people there in Calais because they're like huge jumpers. So what Cameron exactly said was that they're not going to take Syrians from Calais, for example, because that would encourage more people to take this really dangerous journey, which is ridiculous. But so they say they're going to take, now Cameron say they're going to take 20,000 Syrian refugees, but from refugee camps in Lebanon and Turkey, which means it's people that have already been recognized as refugees from the United Nations. But that's going to be under like a vulnerable person scheme, something like that. So they're just going to take like old people who are sick or families with really young people. But they say they're going to take 20,000 in 5 years, which is a very long time. and there is time for the like public pressure to go down, and then these numbers never gonna, yeah, they're never gonna take on these actual numbers, I think.
And there's a special relationship that Britain and the UK have with the rest of the European Union, right? Can you talk about their lack of membership with the Schengen zone and what that means for,
yeah,
for immigration there?
So before, well, in general, there is European Union, there is an area of the European Union, which is all European Union apart from the UK, where there is Schengen area, which means there is not border control between, there is freedom of movement within the European countries. The UK is outside this, so I'm Italian, I have Italian passport, I still need to go through border control when I come to the UK. And that's the reason why people get stuck in Calais generally, because it's easier. It used to be easier to cross from Austria to Germany or to Italy, but the UK is not part of this. And in the last year, the UK has been campaigning a lot about going out of the European Union altogether, because they want more control on who is coming in. Also, European migrants, they don't like us very much as well. So they're kind of trying to get out of all the responsibility they have under the European Union treaty. And they're trying to get the public opinion to think that they're getting invaded, and that's why they need to get out of the European Union. And it's just a few months ago, Calais was on the news every day, and they were talking about it as literally was an invasion, and they were talking about 3,000 people that, you know, like 3,000 people arrived to Italy and Greece like every other day through the boats. But in England, I think it's because it's an island, and they have this impression that like people are gonna just take over their country, which is really not. It's not big numbers.
That seems like the kind of language that would fall right into the hands of anti-immigrant, right-wing and reactionary parties like the British National Party.
Yeah.
Or, you know, National Alliance in Italy or where have you. So you mentioned a discussion about redistributing the responsibility for the migrants coming in. And there's an upcoming conference to talk about that redistribution on October 20th in Brussels.
Yeah.
And in the meantime, it seems like some of the European member states have been sort of redrawing lines on their own to sort of stem the flow of the migrants coming across. And also Northern European states like the UK and also like Germany have made statements about making commitments to like resettle or like trying to press other European states in the meantime to open borders and allow trains to go through to bring migrants up to their countries. Can you talk about what you've seen with that and the migrants that you've spoken with and how that's affected them?
Yeah, I think the European Union has been really schizophrenic in the past weeks and months. So as I was saying, the Schengen area is there and you're supposed to have freedom of movement between countries. But then Ventimiglia, which is this city at the border between Italy and France, has been the border has been closed by France since I think May or June this year. So before it was really easy to come from Italy to France, you just get a train and no one would check your documents. Now the police is checking documents of everyone on the train crossing the border, and people are sent back to Italy. And that's not even completely legal because some people are sent back even not because they've been fingerprinted. So every migrant that does not have the right documents to cross, they're just sent back to the Italian border. And other countries like Germany, so a few weeks ago, Germany was the only positive example in Europe where they were taking lots of refugees coming in, and they were trying to encourage other countries to do the same. But now, yesterday or the day before, I read it. Today's in an article, I'll find it. So now Austria, Germany, Macedonia, and Croatia are closing their borders. So Germany say, yeah, we need to take in that our responsibility. And now they're saying, well, wait a minute, maybe there are too many, and I'll just close the border. And Hungary has shut down completely the border. There is the army patrolling the border. And since yesterday, they put this new law where if you cross the border illegally, you can be put in jail. So we really don't know what is going to happen because we don't know how they're going to enforce this law. But in the meanwhile, people are stuck in no man's land. So in Serbia, there's a lot of migrants that are trying to cross to Hungary and they just stuck. And from one day to the other, the law has changed. And if you do try to cross, you might get jailed. And no one really knows how is that going to evolve and how is that going to go.
What's known about the people that are facilitating refugees coming over? Like, would you, in your understanding, describe them as human traffickers? Or are they, like, I've heard some news reports where they're like, yeah, they're apparently attached to these mafias. I mean, I know that on the southern border between, or southern, the border between Mexico and the U.S., there's generally often connections between cartels and the coyotes that are running people across the border, which could be a very dangerous thing. They could just take your money and leave you somewhere or kill you or enslave you or what have you. But do you know anything about the process from having talked to some of the refugees of how they got here?
The price, for example, from Calais to the UK has doubled if you want someone to help you to get into the truck or to help you to find a truck which has a driver who would be sympathetic, at least if not getting some money. So the harder it is cost, the more the traffickers ask for money because they know that because you in Calais, for example, you pay only if you actually cross. So they get a higher price because if the migrants don't cross and more, it's very likely that they won't cross and they would not get the money. But in general, there's a lot of, these traffickers who get people across the sea, definitely from Turkey to Greece or Italy. As well as it was on the news few weeks ago that 70 migrants were found in a truck in Austria and they were all dead because probably, there were too many people and there was not enough oxygen in the truck. So definitely really dodgy and really dangerous. But then on the other side is a vicious circle. In England, every time a boat sink in the Mediterranean, the head of the Home Office say, well, we need to crack down on traffickers, but traffickers will always be there as long as there is need of someone helping you to cross the border. And there is no way to get rid of traffickers if you make the border harder to cross. On the other hand, there's been a lot of grassroots activists who just decided to bring people over with no exchange of money, which under the law, a trafficker need to get some money from the migrants to be considered a trafficker. So a lot of people, for example, when Hungary stopped the train going to Austria, a lot of people just took their car, went to Hungary and brought back some migrants. And there was this website created in Germany where they were giving advice to people and they were kind of encouraging like holidaymakers coming back from holidays and going back to Germany, just pick up a migrant on the way, and they were just giving tips on how to explain if you were stopped at the border, how to explain that you were not a trafficker, so not to have any cash on you, to show that you were not taking any money from them. And I think that's wonderful. That's the direct action solidarity that we actually need right now, because there's been a lot of money and being fundraising recently, for example, in the UK, after Calais was on the news every day, then a lot of trucks have been going to Calais and unloading like donated goods and clothes and stuff. But talking with the migrants, they really appreciate that, but it's not what they need. They just need to get on with their life and they don't want to depend on people helping them. They want to, to live legally in a country and be able to work or be able to, to do stuff that is not living in jungle and waiting for a van coming from the UK to give you food. So I think, more than like humanitarian aid, what is needed is this direct action fighting the border. That's the only way to, move forward, I think.
We're speaking with Greta, a no border activist based out of the UK. about the situation, the refugee crisis in Calais, France, and throughout Europe. Bringing it back to Calais for a moment, there was a change in the relationship between British security forces and French security forces over the last few months in Calais, from what I recall. Can you talk about that?
So, because how it works in Calais is a bit peculiar, because Calais is in France, but the border of the UK is actually in France, is in Calais. That makes it easier for the UK to actually get less people claiming asylum, because if they were coming to Dover, which is in the UK, and they were claiming asylum, then they would need at least to process their claim, and maybe they then deport them back to Italy or deport them to the country of origin. But as the border is in Calais, they don't need to process anyone there, because it's still France. So it's very weird. And the UK pays French government to control their border. So there is a lot of police, but in the last month, they were talking about bringing the army down to Calais to stop the migrants trying to get across. And was particularly particularly wild, because in the meanwhile, the French workers at the port went on strike for a few weeks. So there was huge traffic jams, and that of course gave greater possibility for the migrants to get across. And I think there is a tension between France and the UK, because France feel that it's true that they're getting paid to do the dirty job, but it is a bit too much. And but on the other hand, the UK just sent something like 12 million to build new fences, and the new fences are up and running now. So I'm not sure what is the, yeah, their diplomatic agreement at the moment, and if France is going to change anything or push the UK to change anything in how they control that border. But for now, it's still working.
Can you talk a little bit to give perspective on what you understand to be the motivation behind the surge in the number of refugees? Like, where are they coming from, and what sort of demographics do they fit in?
So as I say, the main nationalities, I mean, there is few people from a lot of different countries, but in Calais, the main nationality are Syrians, which are fleeing what is well known everywhere. And then there is a lot of males from Afghanistan. So Syrians are male mainly in Calais, but there's also families and young kids. Afghans are mostly men. I haven't met any Afghan woman in Calais, and unaccompanied minors, which is quite typical of a lot of young boys in Afghanistan. Their father got killed by the Taliban or by the government, and the mother feel that the next one is going to be the older son, so they send them to Europe. And then there is a lot of Kurdish from Iraq, Syria, and Iran, and the Kurdish are particularly oppressed now, because ISIS is trying and kill the minority in Syria and Iraq, but also the Kurdish of Iran, as well as the Kurdish in Turkey, are a minority that's always been oppressed.
Are there also some coming from Turkey as well, because of the recent repression against leftist organizations and just Kurdish folks in particular in that country? Or has that not been among the folks that you've seen or interacted with?
I haven't met Kurdish from Turkey in Calais, but that's mainly because as they do have Turkish citizenship, they usually try and get to Europe with a visa and then claim asylum. So I have a friend who is a Kurdish from Turkey. He came to the UK with a visa as a student or something like that, and then claim asylum. While the Kurdish from Syria, Iraq, and Iran need to come all the way by land, because they can't get a visa to come to Europe. And then the other main nationality are Sudanese and Eritreans. In a lot of Eritreans, a lot of women from Eritrea, and that's mainly because they're persecuted by the dictatorship, most of them for religious reasons, and Sudanese mostly from Darfur, but not only. So they are the main nationalities, I would say.
These are mostly places that are suffering from wars currently, and in Syria, it's important to recognize that there's a lot of media, at least in the United States, that talks about Islamic State or Daesh or whatever, but doesn't really talk about the impacts of the fact that the Assad regime is still bombing its populations that aren't directly under its control with barrel bombs and has used chemical weapons in the past. And so a lot of people may be attempting to flee that sort of persecution as well. Is that right?
Yeah, they're kind of attacked on both sides. So I think that's why there is such a massive migration from there.
The last time we chatted, you made the point that immigrants were aware that the destabilization of their homelands by arms and attacks by European and North American powers had driven them north and west, away from their families and homes. Can you talk a little more about this sort of, quote, reaping of the whirlwind, unquote, effect?
Yeah, I think there is a video that came out recently from Calais of these Algerian men speaking with a journalist from the UK. And I think he managed to express really well what most of the migrants feel and how ridiculous it is that Europe does not want to take them, as they know that the reason why they're there in the first place is because European countries and the faith have been messing up with their countries. So you get this a lot, mainly from the Afghans and the Sudanese. They're very well aware of the history of their country and how the only reason why they're there is because, well, in the case of Afghanistan, obviously because of the bombing and the invasion, and Sudanese knows that the British Empire messed up when they left Sudan. And they feel that you want me or not, I have a right to come. And I think that's really fair. And they feel that they're making fun of them, considering how much impact the European had on their country. And I don't know, there was this Afghan guy saying, like, we got invaded by the States and by the UK, and now they're complaining for a bunch of us coming with no bombs and nothing to hurt them, and we just want to come and have a safe place. And also, like, I was talking a lot with the Syrians this time, and they're just so disappointed. It just came out that Cameron said he would take thousands of Syrians from the refugee camps. And a lot of these people were living in refugee camps before coming to Europe. So I talked with this man. He has been living in Lebanon in a refugee camp for a while, and nothing was happening. No one told him that they could ever, ever be resettled in Europe. So he decided to take the risk and come to Europe because, I mean, if you're a Kurdish, for example, from Syria, and you move to Turkey, you're still a Kurdish in Turkey. It's not a safe place for you. So they took the risk and they come to Europe, and then you hear like, well, you should not have come. If you were waiting there, we would come and pick you up. And that's just ridiculous because they know that it's not really happening. And yeah, I'll send you the video of the Algerian man because he was just so good. And the British journalist was trying to tell him, well, yeah, I think it's just really hard for people to accept the responsibility. And, you know, most of humanitarian aid and all this solidarity aid is coming from, not from activists, but from people that maybe were not particularly aware of migrant issues and migrant struggle, and then suddenly got really feeling really compassionate for the situation. I have the feeling that they feel sorry because these people are clearly suffering, but they don't think that it's because of us and that we do have responsibility, not because they're suffering, but because what we did before. So they should just be able to come in a safe way. There is no reason you know, like there was this picture of this toddler, Syrian toddler, who died in Turkey, and it was on the news for days, and it seems that it moved a lot of people, and that created public pressure for Cameron to say, yeah, we're gonna take 20,000 refugees from Syria. But, you know, you hear about boats sinking every day. What do you think that, where do you think that kids are going? They are thinking if they're drawing, and people need to see it in a picture to actually realize what is happening. I think there's not enough historical awareness of the role that European country had in these countries and why these people are coming. And that's why it's easy to say that they're fleeing from ISIS and they are the bad ones. So yeah, that's why, I think that's why we are so much, we have so much empathy for Syrians, because we can recognize that the bad one has nothing to do with us, but that's not how it is. It's just how we categorize that.
The child's, the three-year-old's name was Eylan Kurdi, and he was from Kobani. I had to look that up because I've not seen the pictures, but I've heard it referenced.
It was a big thing for a few days. Everyone was talking about it, and I felt like crying when I saw that. But it's the truth that we know that it's happening every day, and people should feel ashamed every day, because we are forcing families to put their kids on really unsafe boats. And UKIP, so UKIP is the far right party in the UK, and an MP from the UKIP posted on Twitter that the parents of Eylan Kurdi, this little boy, were greedy and queue jumpers, and that's the reason why they put their kid on that boat. And it's just so inhumane, and not even trying to understand that if someone put their 3-year-old kid on a boat, it's because they think that that's the best option, the best shot they have to be alive.
Yeah, they wouldn't be spending all this money on an illegal journey that's so dangerous. And in this case, where his 5-year-old brother and also their mother died on the trip, like that's not the kind of thing that any human being takes very lightly, I'm sure. And the situation, like the refugee crisis in Europe, or the crisis for refugees in Europe, as it's been coming up, has had implications in the United States in terms of not only how the federal government has discussed attempting to alleviate or not the crisis situation there and give refugees a place in the U.S., but also it's been fodder for the far right within the Republican Party during this like beginning of the election season, so that you have like Donald Trump talking about, yes, Hungary has it right. They should build a wall because walls are effective. I've seen the wall in Israel, and ask any Israeli how that wall works for them. And in the United States, it's the same lack of critical thinking about, like, you have, there are international relationships between nation states. There's an economic system or economic systems that interface, that those states interface through and that humans interface with. And for the United States, a lot of people become surprised or like angry that why are all these people coming from South America and Central America and from Mexico? I don't understand the impacts of this, without seeing the actual implications of U.S. foreign policy supporting coups in, you know, in Honduras just recently, or, you know, historically back through the 1950s, back all the way to Guatemala with Ibanez. Like, they don't understand that the funding of death squads throughout Latin America and Central America, or the upending of Allende's government in the 1970s in Chile, and the installation of Pinochet there, like, people wanted to escape and become refugees because of a situation that our government, in order to facilitate economic security, upended the social structure. And as incomplete or imperfect as a democratic election might be under a state and in capitalism, even socialist or whatever, they still don't understand that there's blowback and that people have to go somewhere. If not into mass graves, they have to leave.
It's when it's in April, I think there were 900 migrants died in the Mediterranean, and I'm part of this migrant solidarity group. And we went around giving flyers to people, and I decided I wanted to talk with people, not just to give flyers. And I was asking them how they felt about it. And everyone was like, yeah, it's really sad. But then when I was asking, do you think we do have a responsibility, that the reason why they're on sea risking their lives is kind of our fault? At that point, they were like, what? What are you talking about? Why would you say that? And a lot of people were like, they should just understand that it's too dangerous. They should not come. And I'm really puzzled. I really don't understand how people cannot understand what is happening. And I was trying to give examples. Like, you know, a lot of migrants from sub-Saharan Africa were living in Libya, and they were not coming to Europe there because they were safe enough there. And then we decided that we had to mess up with Libya, and now Libya is not safe, and they need to go farther, and that's why they're coming here. And it's just really hard to accept for people that that we like to go around and decide for other people's life, but then we are not open for other people to come to our countries. And and these numbers, like, I have the impression that when they talk about numbers, it always seems that so high. But when you say when you see the percentage of population, it's not, it doesn't really make a huge impact on our lives, on our cities. And I mean, the UK is a country where I don't know how many millions of houses are empty and no one is living there. We like to build new houses and rent them for a really high price. But then when you talk with people, they're like, yeah, you know, but there's not enough houses for all these people. And they just don't want to hear the facts and numbers. And yeah.
Well, we've been talking a bit about how, like, states interact and how people interact with the numbers and being overwhelmed or scared by the numbers of people that are coming over. The BBC World Service has made a big thing recently on some of their shows of residents of Europe being quite hospitable and welcoming to immigrants and refugees. Have you heard any accounts of that?
I think, as I was saying, there's been a lot of solidarity that appears out of the blue. So, I don't know, a few weeks ago at the stations, I think in Austria or in Germany, people were going and giving water and gifts to the Syrian refugees coming through with the train. And as I say, there's been a lot of nice projects where people were just going and getting people with a car. Now in the UK, a lot of people are saying, I would give my spare room in my house for a Syrian refugee. So they're trying to pressure the government, saying, if you let them in, then they're not going to be a burden on you because I'm going to share what I have, which is beautiful. I'm a bit concerned that it's going to go away, that probably going to be just a temporary thing. I hope that the mind of people is changing. But as I was saying, on the other hand, from my point of view, as an activist, I think it's not enough. People are saying, I feel empathy, I feel compassion, I want to help, but they're not ready to fight the border. And somehow they're just helping where the state should be helping. So people, normal people, need to step in and give food and give water and give shelter. But that should be a responsibility of the government. Shouldn't be people doing that. So it's beautiful. But somehow I think it's just keeping the crisis a bit calmer and not letting it explode as it should, because that it should just, something should change, and nothing's going to change till people have food and water and they're stuck in a camp and they can't move forward.
In your mind, are there conclusions that one could draw from the crisis and the conflictual operations of various states such as Hungary and Germany towards how well the union is faring or the model upon which it's based? Like, you've been talking about needing or seeing the need for the conflict to actually come to a head and not just people offering these social services and charities to people. But what do you think that says about about borders in Europe and the Schengen zone and how the EU is set up?
I think it's probably the first time in the European Union where we face a real challenge inside our territory, and we're failing so badly. I think we're failing the entire world, and we're disappointing everyone, because I think it's finally showing the real face of the European Union, where we pretend, we go abroad and we explain about human rights, and then in our country, as soon as we actually need to show that we are good and we can do good, we're horrible. There are these videos of the army stopping migrants with babies and children in their arms, and they are people that have done nothing. So we are at war. If you see the scenes from East Europe, as well as Calais, we are at war with refugees, and these are people that are seeking safety. The only reason why they're coming to Europe is to have peace and not be in danger, and we are just fighting them. And I think European countries, amongst them, can't agree on anything, because everyone is just looking for their own backyard, and they just care about their own country, and they let country as Greece think in their issues. So of course there's been all the economical side of Greece, but why we were saying you need to pay the debt, we were letting them having to face thousands of refugees, not giving them the support they needed to help these people. So I think Europe is it's a big failure, unfortunately. And you know, you have this part of hope when you see Germany step in and say, we need to open the borders, we need to do something, but then 2 weeks after, they're like, well, no, I changed my mind, I'll close my border. It's not solidarity, and apparently the law is there, but it's not really there, because a country can just close their border and build a wall based on Israeli, an example, and that's really concerning. I think that's why I think that there's need for something more. Like, you know, European Union, all these conventions are all based on what happened in the Second World War. And the German activists who were giving advice to holidaymakers to bring refugees over, they called, it's all in German, I don't speak German, but I got a friend to translate for me. And they were saying that the name they used in the website was the same of this group of Germans who was bringing refugees over from East Berlin to West Berlin at the time of when Germany was divided. And I think their point was really good, was trying to remind people that we have been through this before and we say never again. But now we're doing it just because these people are not European, it's not part of us. But we try and rationalize our fears, saying that they are too many and we want to help, but that's too much. There are too many. They're not. And even if, in my belief, we should share whatever we have. So it's not really a rational point saying, well, we need to protect us, because otherwise they're going to take all the wealth that we have. And yeah, we need to revisit a lot of stuff in Europe.
One or two more questions, and it's okay to, if you don't want to answer them. But one of the arguments that have been hearing against immigration for a long time by reactionaries or by right wingers is this concept of, like, this isn't, as you quoted before, like, this is not a refugee crisis, this is an invasion, they're going to change the nature of European society and culture, and our culture is in danger, which is like a very common trope among white separatists, white nationalists, and white supremacists talking about, like, what this inherent nature to a culture. And for me, when I hear that, I think that is the biggest pile of dog that I've heard, because language and culture and religion, none of it is static, and none of it just came from like seeds. Like it all comes from interaction and interfacing. And I think that anyone who's saying that sort of thing doesn't have any sort of concept of their own history or of how time passes. They just have a static viewpoint that's very reactionary and very idealistic. Is there, have you come across reactionary anti-immigrant folks who are saying that sort of thing?
Yeah, there was a demo in Dover, which is the town in the UK just facing Calais, just last Saturday, where there were a lot of fascists demonstrating and asking for the borders to be closed and we need to protect. There were, I think there was a banner saying, I was watching the news, I think there was a banner saying like, stop the like white genocide or something like that. So yeah, they say that you need to protect the British culture as if that is a thing, and no one really knows what the British culture is apart from tea and talking about the weather. But the truth is, like, I come from Italy, and talking about Italian culture is something that is just funny because we have influences from the Arabs, from the Greek, from the Germans, and Italian culture between the north of Italy and the south of Italy is as diverse as from, yeah, definitely from north of Italy and Syria. I mean, south of Italy is much closer to northern Africa than to Europe. And I don't know, the UK is very multicultural anyway. It's too late. If they want to have a white British culture, they should have thought of that before creating the colonies and the Commonwealth and all that. And I think people are scared, of course, and it's normal. Of course, it brings a change. Like in London, in many classes, most of the kids, their mother tongue is not English. But if you let people in and work with them, their kids will speak English. The next generation is going to speak a perfect English, but they're also going to have very beautiful influences from other places. And I'm not saying that it's easy, of course, but inevitable, it's gonna happen anyway. That's what I think. Is like the impression I have is that we are trying to stop them. It's never gonna happen. It's just more people are gonna die trying, but there's no way to stop that as long as the causes of the migrant crisis is not resolved, and doesn't seem that it's gonna happen anytime soon. So we just need to find a way. It's for a culture having a nation that is just marginalized, isolated, and living in a camp, it's just not going to help anyone. It's, you know, most of these people, like, I have a friend who's been in Calais, and then he crossed, and he got deported back to Italy, and I saw him again in Calais, and it's just painful, because he's 22 years old, young, and clever, and speaks six languages, and would love to do something of his life, and would be a great contribution. I don't think people should be let in just because they're a contribution to society, but even wanting to use that argument, they could be.
For English-speaking members of the audience, what would be, are there any good news sources for folks to pay attention to what's been going on with good perspectives?
Well, for Calais specific, I try and follow on Calais Migrant Solidarity. They have like a website where they put, and is a website written up by activists, so it's always people that are on the ground and are often on the ground, or they're always on the ground when they're writing. At least there's a lot of journalists just going for a couple of days not really understanding what is happening and writing articles about that, and then I'm not sure, sorry. I can send you maybe some more information if you can then spread them around once I have time to look into it.
There's there's a lot of links on the side of that on the blog roll. There's stuff in English, stuff in French, stuff in Spanish. So there is a English page on the beatingborders.wordpress.com, which is the No Borders Morocco. So listeners can check that out. We've been speaking with Greta, who's an anti-border or no borders activist based out of the UK currently, about her experience in Calais, France.
Thank you very much.
You're listening to WSFM LP 103.3 in Asheville, North Carolina. This is The Final Straw, a weekly anarchist radio show airing on Sundays between 2 to 3 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. I'm Bursa Goodness.
And I'm William Goodenough.